Don't you know, we're talking about a revolution. Sounds
It's the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. I'm your host, Walt Thiessen, here with co-host Bill Westmiller. Today is Thursday, May 23rd, 2013, and here are some of the headlines we'll be looking at today. We'll take a look at snooping on the Associated Press, a little tidbit about the taxes on the wealthy French, shortages on basics in Venezuela, a little bit of funny, a little bit of sad going on there. Did you know that the U.S. has a health dictator? We'll talk about her a bit. There's the endless war on terror and some rather disturbing terrorism charges against a teenager. And if we can get to them, we'll talk about Bitcoin and gold demand. But we're going to start off the hour with the IRS scandal that we touched on last week. And there's perhaps some new news that came out of it. Bill discovered something kind of unusual, perhaps the idea that disclosure was planted. Bill, what did you find?
Well, the bottom line is that the Inspector General had done a review, an audit, whatever, of the IRS operations, and it mentioned one little section that the procedures for determining who are qualified to be tax-exempt organizations was being done in apparently partisan fashion. Ooh. Namely, they've been picking out Tea Party groups and Patriot groups and so on for special review and postponing the consideration and approval of those tax-exempt authorizations. And that report went to the White House. The White House said, well, we don't really want this to come out because it looks kind of bad, so let's sit on it for a while. They knew this in 2012 before the election, and so they passed it along to one of their people that was involved in the IRS operations, and they said, well, let's have somebody ask you a question about it in one of these meetings. And you can answer the question and kind of shrug it off and say, yeah, we made a mistake and we're sorry about it. And so basically what happened was that in order to disclose this in the most obscure, quiet way possible, they planted a question in a meeting, and I don't have the name of the person that was actually giving the meeting or giving the talk. But she answered the question and shrugged it off, and it was a two-sentence answer, and nobody much paid any attention, you know, until the media got a hold of it, until they started finding out there were other things going on. So it's interesting in the respect of how do you handle bad news. And as usual, the cover-up and the secrecy involved in these kind of tax review procedures is so bound up with all these bureaucratic rules that they have to cover up these little foibles and errors and biases among their own personnel. So this was an example of the way you handle bad news, and this planting of a question in an obscure setting was supposed to eliminate all of the public rancor and irritation that the IRS was actually favoring one political group over another. So it's kind of an interesting background on how, you know, administrations handle political problems.
So is there any word as to whether or not the advisors who suggested this particular approach are still working at the White House?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, as a matter of fact, the person who was responsible for that particular division was transferred out 6 months ago before it really got into the media, and she's now running the Obamacare program.
Oh, well, that's reassuring.
But there's so much detail that's intriguing about the way they did it and the reasons why they did it. For example, there were more than 90 Tea Party groups that were targeted in this program. They had, on average, less than $25,000 in donations. But there were so many politicians who were scared of the Tea Party and these patriot groups after the 2010 elections that there were actually six senators who wrote a letter to the IRS saying, you have to be very, very careful about these crazy people that are involved in politics and make sure that they don't get tax-exempt status. This was an explicit letter signed by six U.S. senators. Simultaneously, the Washington Post and New York Times said, hey, this is crazy. We shouldn't be giving tax-exempt status to patriot groups and Tea Party groups. It's giving them an advantage they shouldn't have. So that's the background for why this thing actually came up. It's basically just, like I said last week, a couple dozen kids in Cincinnati wanted to make their bosses happy.
Yeah.
So it's interesting.
What's the partisan divide on the six senators?
Take a guess. They were all concerned about the Tea Party.
Yeah, okay. Well, it kind of makes sense, but I just thought I'd ask.
They were five or six Democratic senators, yes.
Okay. It could have been Republicans, because Republicans have been targeted by the Tea Parties in the primary.
Well,
so it could have been.
I suppose that there were many establishment Republicans who were scared to death of the Tea Party. You're probably happy if they were getting nailed by the IRS when it came to getting 501c4 status. So it was probably a multi-partisan agreement that was something that the IRS had to take care of.
It's also interesting that the chairman of the Republican National Committee, I believe it was, and Senator Rand Paul both distanced themselves from cries for impeachment of President Obama over the IRS scandal. I thought that was a fascinating thing.
Yeah, well, some politicians are concerned about attributing to Obama something that had really nothing to do with him. There were political operatives in the White House, apparently in the Justice Department that supervises the IRS, who knew that this thing had gone a little haywire.
Mm.
And so they never told Obama about it. This was just prior to the 2012 election. So they didn't want that issue to come up until after the election, and they wanted it to come up in the most obscure setting possible.
I guess they succeeded on that score because it's well after the election, and it did make quite a ruckus. It probably will continue to make a ruckus, but it's about in the least sensitive portion of the four-year cycle on elections. So I think they probably succeeded.
Yeah, it's fairly well managed, and the IRS scandal is kind of being obscured by the snooping.
Associated Press, which
directly affects the media.
Yeah, and I guess it's not terribly surprising that the media is paying a little more attention to that one. The latest on that is that what is it? It's an Al Qaeda plot that was released that was revealed by in the course of this scandal that later was revealed as being a situation where the AP were being snooped on, and the concern was that release of this information would put the U.S. at risk. And so I guess that's the big debate right now between the people who are, the real pro-high security folks and the civil liberties folks, if you will.
Yeah, well, the thing that makes it troublesome politically is when the actual facts come out of what transpired. For example, the AP described the process that they had gotten this information about this plot in Yemen, and they knew that the CIA had foiled this bombing plot that some Al Qaeda types had instigated anyway, but the CIA had foiled it. So they called up the CIA and they said, "Well, we've got the story, and we got it from anonymous sources that you foiled this plot. It's really great. We want to publish it. Is that okay?" And the CIA people said, "Well, yeah, you're not supposed to know about that, but we're going to do a release on it in a couple of weeks, and put out a public notice on what happened. So just hold off on the story for a week or so." So they held off on the story for a week or so, and then they called them up. They said, "We're going to, we haven't heard anything, but when are you going to put this out?" "Oh, we're going to put it out tomorrow." "Well, we're going to go ahead and publish a story today." "Oh, okay." And so the AP published a story on the basis of anonymous sources in the CIA. And the next day, the New York Times came out with an exhaustive description of every little tiny aspect of this Al Qaeda plot, mm-hmm. and what transpired and so on. But the CIA had said, well, you know, the guy that, you know, foiled the plot, we're getting him out of the situation. He's gone now. He's not no longer in any danger. But the fact that the AP had gone one day earlier than the administration wanted to release this information prompted them to file charges and allegations that resulted in this warrant to wiretap, I think it was 20 different phones at the Associated Press, and apparently dozens of others that haven't even been disclosed yet. They're slowly trickling out as to what they were doing, monitoring reporters who were privy to this kind of secret information. So it's an intriguing, again, a problem-handling kind of experience that's very similar to the IRS situation.
Now, the question that occurs to me is, are we sure that there was actually a warrant here? This wasn't one of those warrantless searches authorized under the Patriot Act or anything.
Yeah, well, what it highlights is the fact that the response from the Homeland Security Department and the CIA was, well, we have provisions and procedures for properly handling warrants for disclosure of classified information. But they never admitted that they got a warrant. No one has ever seen a warrant. Mm. So it may have been strictly an administrative order that prompted all this wiretapping. It may have had nothing to do with, you know, probable cause that there was any risk whatsoever to national security.
And this starts to expose what happens when you do have warrantless search go on, because ultimately, this is a relatively mild example of it, to be perfectly honest, but ultimately warrantless searches can be used to, among other things, muzzle the press.
Just sure, because intimidation. Not only are they secret, but nobody's ever told that they occur.
Right.
It only happened accidentally that the AP wiretaps were disclosed to the AP that they had this information.
Mm-hmm.
And so they didn't disclose anything about James Rosen, but James Rosen got an FOIA and discovered that the IRS, this is a Fox News reporter, the IRS, not the IRS, but the CIA had done a similar thing with him. They had actually hacked in and read all of his emails. And there was no indication of, you know, the fact that they were doing that. In that particular case, the administration or the CIA or whoever, Homeland Security, had actually gotten a warrant. And they got a secrecy provision put in for 60 days. Well, after 60 days, the court released the notice to Fox News that James Rosen had had his emails absconded with for weeks on end on a totally different issue.
Mm-hmm.
So it just balloons and balloons and balloons. And the question I asked was, you know, if the AP did something wrong, the New York Times, the very next day, even before the administration announced this thing, published this massive, huge article detailing everything that went on in Yemen, who the guy was, without naming his name, that he worked for Saudi Arabian intelligence, not the U.S. intelligence. He wasn't a CIA operative, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and so on and so forth. Now, where did the New York Times get all that information from?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Obviously from the same CIA sources the AP did.
Right.
There's no indication and no report yet, although it could very easily come out, that the New York Times was being wiretapped by the CIA or the Homeland Security or whatever, just as much as the AP was. But you'll never discover it because there was no warrant.
I think it's likely that they probably were, but I think there's also an important difference, and this gets at what I was talking about. The difference is that the New York Times is generally perceived to be a liberal-leaning paper, so since the Democrats are in power, they would tend to be, you know, somewhat lenient toward the liberal-leaning paper. They'd be willing to, if they're going to leak something, they'd leak it through that paper and so on and so forth. Whereas if they felt that the AP was a little bit on the conservative side for their taste, then they might come down on them. And my point was, if you have the ability to issue a warrantless search, you know, not, I shouldn't say issue, to conduct a warrantless search where you don't actually have to have a warrant to get the search, and you don't have to reveal the fact that there is a warrant because the Patriot Act expressly gives you the power to not have to reveal it. And, in fact, you can even prevent others from revealing it under threat of imprisonment for violation of the law. You essentially set up a scenario under which a sort of a power politics patronage system of news media shift goes on, so that those who are in favor with the administration, whoever the current administration is, while they may be checking their emails, they're going to get more favored status in terms of getting the news. Whereas if you're not in good favor, not only could you not get the news in the way you wanted to, but they could actually threaten you, saying, well, we also found through our warrantless searches that you were investigating A, B, and C. So if you pursue the idea of revealing this story, we're going to take you to court not only for that, but we're also going to drag you into court for this other thing that's completely unrelated. And we're going to start trumping up charges against you. That's what you end up heading toward with this kind of thing.
Yeah, and the key word is this happens in all administrations.
Right.
And this isn't an anti-Obama thing. This has been going on for decades. The administration can mark anything classified that they want. There's probably 90 billion documents out there that have been marked as classified.
Yeah.
They release the ones that make them look good.
Right. Yep.
Because they have, the president and the vice president have total discretion on what is or isn't classified, and they can leak whatever they think is valuable to their image to whatever newspapers are their best friends.
Mm-hmm.
And they hide everything else. And if yep. somebody else finds out something that's, you know, detrimental to them or looks bad, there's hell to pay. And it is true, though, you know, aside from, you know, what other presidents have done, Obama has been one of the strictest, strongest enforcer of the secrecy laws.
Mm.
They filed more charges against people for leaking information than any other, as a matter of fact, all administrations prior to that.
Wow.
The Obama administration is extremely, you know, covetous of anybody releasing anything that they haven't approved and spun to their satisfaction.
Now, of course, this program's main orientation is the money supply, monetary system, and financial situation related to that. So why would we focus on the IRS and the AP? Well, the fact that you have an expansionary monetary system, that's where government power keeps increasing. And when you keep increasing government power, it also gets you the ability to start putting through laws like the Patriot Act and so on, which enable you to get into these situations where you can just keep expanding the power of the administration that's currently in charge. So one actually directly feeds the other. And, in fact, it doesn't just happen in this country. It happens in countries all around the world. Similar kind of thing has happened over in Europe. France, in particular, has experienced it in a way that's not perhaps directly related to the power grab, although that power grab is certainly involved, but it is directly related to the monetary system and how it's impacted the economy over there, because now the government's are all, not just the French government, but all of the governments, Italy and Portugal and all the rest of them, are struggling to survive under what they rather humorously describe as austerity. I think you and I would probably disagree with that term, but that's the way they look at it. And as a result, they're now doing some rather severe taxing, even over above the severe taxing they used to have. In fact, it's gotten pretty bad in France, hasn't it?
Yeah, before we go to that story, and it ties in, let me comment on your relationship to the monetary system.
Oh yeah, sure.
The principle of being a forceful administration who is in control of not just the world but news about the world applies just as much to monetary or IRS or CIA or anybody else. The Fed for decades ran totally secretly. They told nobody what they did. Nobody had any idea exactly what was going on with the monetary supply because they didn't want people to know.
That's right.
Only in the past 6 months or so, maybe a year, that the Fed has actually been disclosing what they're buying. You know, they're spending $40 billion on Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. They're buying $40 billion worth of treasuries every month.
And even that, we aren't sure that's everything. We just know that that's what they told us about. There could be a lot
exactly.
more we don't know about.
Exactly, because everything the Fed does, they tell you about 6 weeks after it happens. So it's the insiders that get the information first that are able to take advantage of it. Well, that same secrecy and control fanaticism applies not just to monetary policy, but also to foreign policy and intelligence and tax enforcement.
That's right.
So I wanted to just, concur that secrecy is the key to controlling society.
Oh, yeah.
If nobody knows what's going on, they can't oppose it.
I agree.
But in France, at least as far as IRS-type things and taxes, the story was that there are 8,000 French households who now have income tax bills exceeding 100% of their income. In other words, every dime you make plus whatever dimes you have in the bank, they are taxing. The people who are paying the income tax have had all of their assets, all of their income, plus additional assets of like $1.6 million simply taken away by France's socialist government. They imposed a tax surcharge shortly after they took office, and it was to offset other expenses they had. But for a period of time last year, the actual surtax resulted in an income tax rate in excess of 100%.
And there's no indication that this is going to be the end of it, because it's not like austerity is done. It's not like the financial crisis over there is done. They've got a long way to go.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, and what it is when an income tax exceeds 100% of income, what it really is a wealth tax. It's
right.
A tax on assets. Not that assets are moved and as income or outgo or whatever it is, but that they're depleting the wealth of the wealthiest by
and
having
some,
a tax.
There are some who advocate that. There are some who think that's a good idea.
Yeah.
Who say that, we should be taxing the wealth of the very wealthy because they've got plenty as it is. But there's a couple of really important factors that view overlooks, as you know very well. One of which is if you keep doing that consistently and you make it so punitive to stay in the country, they won't.
Well, not just that. I mean, if they're taxing 100% of the income plus, they're taking out of the private economy all of the people that might have an interest in investing in worthwhile, productive private businesses.
Right.
That money just disappears.
Yeah.
And
absolutely.
So it's the government, it's fascism in a sense, or Nazism, whatever you want to call it. It's the government taking over the economy, and they've done that in so many different aspects with such an extreme degree over the past, 50 decades.
Well, they probably take exception to being called fascists or Nazis because they don't have spiders for logos and they don't go around with one-armed salutes. But nevertheless, the policies of economic kind are definitely related.
Well, the difference between Nazism and communism is that in Nazism, individuals own their own business, but the government controls it. In other words, the government has total control over the business. In communism, you don't have private ownership. It goes to the ownership of the state, and the state, the government itself, owns the business and controls the business.
Mm-hmm.
So there's only a slight variation in who nominally owns any particular business operation in the economy. But they're exactly the same kind of statism, the same kind of state control over the economy. It's just one slight variation in who claims ownership and who gets a cut of the benefits.
Which is pretty wild when you consider that to a large part of World War II was about communism versus fascism. It's kind of bizarre.
they just flipped the coin and said, well, let's make it 50-50. Let the private economy keep half and we'll take half and, we won't have to fight.
Wasn't that what Yalta was about? No, forget that. sorry, I couldn't resist that one. But the thing that gets me is they like you said, they're basically discouraging companies from investing in France. They're all, and like I said, they're driving the people who are already there with money out of France. I mean, yeah, you end up perhaps temporarily filling a gap, but what do the French socialist politicians, I don't care about their socialist philosophy, I mean just the practicality of it, what do they think is actually going to happen? Because it doesn't look like to me that what they're doing has any rational sense to it other than just, you know, cover the dike for another day. Do you see it any differently?
No, it's a fundamental philosophical viewpoint, and the viewpoint is that the government, as a representative of the collective or whatever it is wiser and smarter than the selfish people in the private economy, and therefore they can allocate funds better for the benefit of everyone, and there's equal, not just equal opportunity, but equal outcomes, and that they spread the wealth equally among the entire population. And that's what they consider a moral, political goal for politics.
It's pretty scary to have that kind of position and to have this kind of policy and know perfectly well that the policy can't work. I mean, that's really something. And of course, we're seeing the same thing in Venezuela, too. In fact, you found a rather sick/funny story on the topic because Venezuela took all their gold back, so everybody thinks, well, that means they're going to be in good shape, but that's not necessarily the way that works. And now that their dictator is dead and a new dictator is taking over, basically it's business as usual, which basically means that Venezuela steals from all the productive classes and gives to the poor, and the poor love that, so they keep putting them into office. But even so, even with all the stealing and distributing to the poor and Robin Hooding, it isn't working out so well because there are major shortages, including food shortages.
Well, the problem is that socialism claims that these wise government overseers can do precise mathematical calculations of exactly what the price ought to be for any particular product. Now, it's been disproved 100 times over. But
sure.
When it comes down to the nitty-gritty, things like toilet paper, their pricing system doesn't correlate with the cost of the toilet paper. It doesn't correlate with the demand for toilet paper. So what they have to do is the socialist government of Venezuela will have to import 50 million rolls of toilet paper at its own expense just so people in Venezuela can finally be able to wipe their asses.
So that's what's really, really bizarre about it is you have a shortage of food and a shortage of toilet paper. I mean, it goes in one end out the other.
Because government price controls, and government price controls are the government saying, here's what we think the price should be. It is not going to be left up to consumers to decide how much they're going to spend on toilet paper or food or whatever it is. We are going to decide what the proper price is. And you cannot charge less, and you cannot charge more.
What makes it really interesting and both interesting and sad at the same time is that despite all this, the Venezuelan government will continue to get support from the poor because the poor are so devastatingly poor in that country. And yet very few, virtually none, have made any connection to the fact that their poverty is being caused by the exact same thing that's driving what we talked about earlier, the power grab here in the United States and the high taxes in France and so forth, and that is monetary expansion. You put monetary expansion in the hands of government, and they can wreak all kinds of havoc, and then they can say, hey, we just broke your leg, but we gave you a crutch, so here, now you can walk around.
The 12-month inflation rate in Venezuela has hit nearly 30% per year.
Ouch.
Shoppers spend days, or if not weeks, looking for basic items, and whenever they find them, they buy them up. And so it's both a combination of shortages and a combination of government's wisdom in controlling the market that's causing them all kinds of problems. And the poor are not benefiting. There have been a number of studies done showing that the poor in Venezuela are poorer than they were before the socialist government took over and started controlling things.
Right, and that's really, really sad. Well, let's take a break, and after the break, we'll see how the same kind of thought process is being applied to healthcare in this country, and plus we'll look at the war on terror and other good, juicy things after that. This is the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown, here on the Progressive Radio Network, and we will be right back. Talking about a revolution. Talking about a revolution.
Walt Thiessen and Bill Westmiller here on the Freedom News Hour Surviving Meltdown. And let's take a look at how all this wonderful government regulation and control of the economy has affected healthcare. We've talked quite a bit recently, Bill, about Obamacare and all the different ways that it's kind of falling apart, the wheels are falling off. But apparently that doesn't stop the situation with the head of health becoming her own little dictatorship. In fact, she's created quite a little bit of a mini government, if you will, around her office.
Well, she didn't create it. It was created intentionally by Congress. You remember back in the 2008 election when Sarah Palin, who I dislike enormously, started talking about death panels?
Yes, right.
She got the details a little bit wrong, but she was saying that there's built into Obamacare are these panels who are going to ration health care and decide who lives and dies. Big
right.
records. Oh, no, it doesn't exist. Well, the panel is called the Independent Payment Advisory Board. Now, the Independent Payment Advisory Board is the provision in Obamacare that is granted almost total authority to ration payments, not ration services, but ration payments for services through the health care system, not just Medicare and Medicaid, but anything through the insurance exchanges set up in Obamacare.
Mm-hmm.
Now, here's the interesting thing that Congress did. They approved this particular section of the bill with the IPAB, the Payment Advisory Board, and they said any rules that the IPAB makes cannot be disproved by the Congress unless there are three-fifths of the members that pass a joint resolution overturning it.
Mm-hmm.
Same three-fifths requirement if they want to abolish the IPAB. Now, another little clause that you didn't know about until after it was passed was that the president appoints the members of this payment advisory board, right? But if he doesn't appoint anyone, all of those powers fall to one person, the Secretary of Health and Human Services, Kathleen Sebelius.
Mm-hmm.
So what could very easily happen is that the president could either refrain from appointing any members to this payment advisory board, which goes into effect next year, or he could appoint people and the Congress could block the appointments. Well, if they do that, for as long as those appointments are blocked, as long as the board doesn't exist, Kathleen Sebelius can decide what medical treatments any private physician or hospital is going to provide and what the price will be that the government will pay for it, or actually the insurance companies will pay for it. She is going to have total authority to ration all medical services and ration the payment for all medical services totally at her own discretion. That's what Congress approved.
Now, there's, of course, a rather difficult consideration in there, and I don't know if it's been challenged yet, but I wouldn't be surprised if it is challenged. And that is, the Constitution really doesn't give Congress any authority at all to require three-fifths in order to overturn a law.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's obviously unconstitutional for Congress to delegate powers that it doesn't possess to an independent agency that it can't eliminate. I mean,
it can't even restrict its own power by saying that it can put it into law with a majority, but it can't repeal it without three-fifths. I mean, there's just no constitutional authority for that at all.
Yeah, not only that, but there was another provision that says even if they do repeal it, the IPAB has to continue to exist for at least 6 months after Congress repeals it. Now, here's the constitutional issue. The constitutional issue is any Congress can pass any law they want to anytime they want to. They can repeal any law they want to anytime they want to, so no Congress can actually impose an obligation on a future Congress because every future Congress is independent. That's the way the Constitution is written.
Right.
So this kind of provision where one Congress is trying to bind all future Congresses and preclude them from adopting or repealing laws is obviously unconstitutional.
Yeah.
Why hasn't it been challenged? Because it can't be challenged until it actually goes into effect. And it doesn't actually go into effect until next year. So it can't be challenged in the courts. It can't go to the Supreme Court to say it's unconstitutional until after it's been implemented.
Well, maybe. I mean, we've had laws that were challenged preemptorily before. It's not like there's no precedent for that. But your point is still a valid point. The difference
is that when they challenge something that's going to be put in place, they can give you a good reason why they feel that the plaintiffs feel that they will be damaged. In this particular case, because there is no restriction or provisions or requirements on the IPAB to do anything, nobody can claim that they're going to be harmed until the IPAB actually does something, or Kathleen Sebelius actually does something.
Well, here's no way to
get it into the court system.
Here's where I think it would get really interesting, though. Let's say it comes up again for a vote, either before or after it gets implemented. And let's say the Congress votes to repeal it without a three-fifths majority. They just have a simple majority. Okay, so you have one Congress that said one thing and a second Congress that said the other thing. Which side does the Attorney General take?
The Attorney General takes whatever side the President takes. And the President, obviously, if that were to be repealed, he wanted that in there, he's not going to sign the legislation. So the repeal is not effective, no matter how many people vote for it in Congress. You can have unanimous vote by the House of Representatives and the Senate to repeal that provision, and if Obama doesn't sign it, it's not repealed.
But that's if President Obama is still president. I mean, this could also happen after it gets implemented and after a new president comes in. So now there's a new president in there, and he may or may not decide to sign it. But let's say he decides to sign it. Okay, so he signs it. Either way you look at it, it means that regardless of which way the president tells the Attorney General to act, the Attorney General is basically suing the United States.
Well, if the Attorney General was not supportive of this provision of Obamacare, and the Congress passed to overturn it and was vetoed, it would have to be challenged by somebody else who claimed that they had violated this prior rule of three-fifths, which would probably have to be somebody in the IPAB. And so what would have to be somebody or the Secretary of Health and Human Services would have to sue the President and the Congress saying that they couldn't repeal this thing because a prior law had stipulated they required a three-fifths vote. So there's a fantastic legal muddle in terms of who's going to defend what and who's going to complain about what. But because the IPAB is totally independent of Congress, theoretically, if they had people who were appointed that were on the board, they could sue the U.S. government if a future president decided to repeal their existence.
Mm-hmm.
They could take it to court and say, hey, you can't repeal us. We're immune.
Which is also ridiculous, but nevertheless, it's gotten to the point where the entire legal system is ridiculous.
Fun and games. Fun and games.
Yeah. For those of us who have a very sick sense of humor. Speaking of sick senses of humor, the war on terror started by President Bush and carried on by President Obama has been pretty much presumed to be forever, or at least for a very, very long time. President Bush said it was going to last decades, perhaps even 100 years or more. And under President Obama, it shows no sign of ending. In fact, it looks like it's going to be going on continuously forever. It certainly feeds the idea, I can't remember what the name of the philosopher is, the pundit who came up with this, but it feeds the idea that war is the health of the state and that the state intends to be extremely healthy ad infinitum.
Yeah.
And that's pretty much what it is. It never ends, and it never will end. It raises a question, too.
Yeah. Glenn Greenwald is a columnist who used to be at Salon magazine, and is a constitutional scholar and just an extremely well-informed commentator. And he pointed out the war on terror cannot and will not end on its own for two reasons. First of all, it's designed by its very terms to be permanent. In other words, it says this war goes on as long as there is such a thing as called terrorism anywhere in the world, whether it's terrorism in Bangladesh or Afghanistan or whatever it is. And number two, the nation's most powerful political and economic factions get a bonanza of benefits from its continuation. This is what Eisenhower talked about, the military-industrial complex.
Mm-hmm.
The U.S. government has to have wars because it's the only way to get rid of the bullets and the bombs so that the military-industrial complex can make more of them. How can they make a profit? How can they keep Boeing going if if they don't have wars? They got to have wars, otherwise there's no demand for what the Boeing and the other military contractors produce. You have to have a war.
And
that's basically what the AUMF, the Authorization for the Use of Military Force, supposedly initiated. Supposedly a equivalent to a declaration of war against Afghanistan, but the way it's worded, it says that as long as there are potential threats against the United States from anyone who can even remotely be associated with Al-Qaeda, that we are in a state of war, and we will continue to be in a state of war.
It's not just Al-Qaeda either. It's anything that the government decides is terrorism. That's one of the things that's really slippery about the whole war on terror thing, because terrorism is whatever the government says it is. They aren't held accountable for any kind of, what is your definition? What definition are we going to stick to? It's just whatever, the flavor of the week is.
Yeah. Well, but they have to do this little tie-in, because the way the AUMF is written is it has to be a war against someone who is associated with. It doesn't say who decides that they're associated. All it says is that if the government decides it is associated with Al-Qaeda, who did 9/11 on us, then they are terrorists. Now, you notice in the Boston Marathon bombing, they went to great pains to try to associate the two guys with a rebellious group in that supposedly had some remote connection with Al-Qaeda terrorists who were fighting against the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan or whatever it was. They had to come up with this little tie-in, because that was what made it terrorism. It had something to do with Al-Qaeda, or more directly, it had something to do with Islam, or more directly, it had something to do with Muslims and jihads. So they've got to do this little tie-in thing to justify everything, but they do it on every single case where they have done something already, and they're just looking for a justification. But that's the way the AUMF was written. That's the way Congress passed it. They agreed to all of these provisions.
But of course, it's not really any kind of a restriction. It's just it makes them jump through a hoop or two that they have to invent something, because it's gotten to the point that that's what they're doing. They're just inventing stuff. The charges that are coming out against people are becoming thinner and thinner. I mean, there's the case of Cameron D'Ambrosio, an 18-year-old from a small town outside of Boston, wants to be a rapper, and he got arrested and is now facing terrorism charges and 20 years in prison for something he posted on Facebook. Even though the police, the chief of police heading the division that is investigating it, has stated clearly that there is no evidence at all that he was actively engaged in any kind of terroristic activities. So essentially, and I guess there's also surrounding evidence that suggests that he's had violence issues, anger issues in the past, but nothing that actually ties into anything terroristically involved. And yet, he is currently in prison without bail, facing this 20-year prison sentence. And none of the civil liberties organizations are willing to jump in and do anything about it. And it's gotten to the point now where essentially all you have to do is say something that somebody else doesn't like, and they can just cry terrorism, to heck with having to do anything really constructive or clear or direct to tie you to Al-Qaeda. All they have to do is say it. They probably walk through the hoops to say, we found this connection over here, but they don't have to justify it. There's no second guessing. There's no checking it or anything like that. It's just, okay, we found an allegation, so there it is.
Well, the ethic, and it is common among all the neoconservatives, is that it isn't true that all Muslims are terrorists, but all terrorists are Muslims. And therefore, they have to be associated with a radical division of Muslim belief, which is Al-Qaeda. So if there's anybody that even remotely threatens any kind of violence against innocents, they have to be terrorists, because they have to be associated with Muslims. And so that's what they do. And in this particular case, this kid said, well, F Boston bomb, wait till you see the S that I can do. I'd be famous rapping and beat every murder charge that comes across me. Okay, so the implication there is he's threatening, mass violence against multiple people. Now, the problem is that because they can't use the standard common law against him, because criminal threatening, which is the legal classification here of making a threat, requires that he have actually some ability to do this and makes a specific threat against a specific group of people. Well, he never did any of those things. And so they use a terrorism clause, say he's a terrorist, defining terrorism as any kind of threat to cause mass violence or murders, and they prosecute him on the terrorism law because the common law it doesn't allow them to do that. So they use these terrorism laws all the time to prosecute people for things that would not otherwise be crimes.
You mentioned also how this whole thing is applied to Islam and how the neocons make a point to say that all Muslims are not terrorists, but all terrorists are Muslim, and therefore, yada, yada, yada. What's particularly poignant about that is if you look, and it's very often hard to see because they don't share a whole lot of this information, but if you look and see who's being associated with extremist Muslim organizations, it turns out that virtually all the Muslim organizations in existence are being treated as extremist, which raises the question, who are the moderates in the eyes of the neocons? As far as I can see, there aren't any.
Well, and... I don't know if you want to get in this too much. The neocons are just one segment of a broad portion of the electorate that of what are different Christian denominations that believe that the purpose the U.S. Came into existence was to destroy all non-Christian nations, and so. It's very explicit in a lot of religions, and maybe you can call them cults, I suppose, in a sense. But there is a belief that there is a worldwide competition between Christianity and Islam, and the U.S. has to be on the side of Christianity and kill all of the Muslims. I mean, that is a common religious belief, and it carries over into the whole war on terrorism. Saying that all these Muslims are terrorists, we're not going to distinguish between radicals that propose one particular method of terrorism or another. We're going to totally ignore the 7.9 billion Muslims who explicitly say that terrorism is a sin, because that's our worldview, is that we have to have this crusade against Muslims because the Christians have to take over the world.
It is a particularly poignant and rather obvious, I think, although I'm surprised that most people don't see it as obvious parallel that goes on here, because we live in an age where anytime anybody says anything that even hints at the idea that the Holocaust is overstated or that Israel has too much power or whatever, it's always go back to recognizing that the Jews were targeted. They were dragged into the concentration camps. We must never let that happen again, yada, yada, yada. And yet, here we are seeing many of the same people who make that argument, making the same argument that we should treat the Muslims the way that the Jews were treated 60, 70 years ago. That's where we're headed. As far as I can see, I don't see anything that's diverting that. I mean, maybe you see it differently, but it looks to me that's the path that we're currently on. And I don't know how long it'll take to get there, but I can certainly see the day come where these fanatics basically corral the country into believing that we've got to eliminate the Muslims, which I think is horrible, but nevertheless, I think that's where we're headed.
I didn't look up any polls or surveys or whatever, but there are, it's called dominionism in the Christian faith, and it's a fairly strong segment in general Lutheran churches and so on. That the second coming of Christ can't occur until after there's a worldwide war between the two religions. I mean, that war has to happen. And if God doesn't cause it to happen, they're going to make it happen.
Mm.
And so it becomes a religious war, and the more the theocratic ideas get into U.S. politics, either blatantly or by subversion, the more and more we're heading toward another religious worldwide war. In the case of Nazism, it was a secular war against a particular religious minority, but now it's a totally different. It's almost gotten to the point of being equivalent to the Holy Roman Empire taking on and conquering the heathens in the Middle East.
And I have to admit, I reached a point, particularly in my younger years, where I had honestly believed that we were past that kind of crusade mentality. I really thought that we were. And so it was a bit of a wake-up call for me when we got into the 1990s and I found that it wasn't true. And it was even more of a wake-up call for me when I realized that not only was it true that we were still in a crusade mentality, but the vast majority of the population are unwilling to admit it despite the fact that they support the exact same forces that are creating that mentality. That's the part that's really mind-boggling to me.
Maybe for next week I'll do a little check on some of the various polls about attitudes toward religious war and Muslims versus Christians, just to see what the public attitudes are. I think it's diminished a little bit over the past few years, but I think it's still a very dominant factor.
Yeah, you're right. There are a lot of positive signs, and I do like and applaud those positive signs, and I hope they continue. I'm very concerned that it wouldn't take a whole lot to turn that around on a dime. All it takes is one very skilled leader to come into power, manipulate the situations to create another event that demands immediate military response from the United States, and essentially orchestrates a war on Islam. I can easily see that happen despite the gains that have been made. I'd love to say that the gains that have been made will counteract that. I just don't know if it's true.
Well, society evolves in very peculiar ways.
Yeah.
But I'll point out one before we have to close here. One aspect that is something people need to be conscious of. And it actually occurs in very libertarian and progressive publications as well. When you see someone attack a person or an idea as jihad, identifying that as the equivalent of Al-Qaeda, they are totally distorting the whole premise of Islam.
Oh, yeah.
Jihad means struggle.
That's what the word means.
It means struggle. That's what
that's
it means.
Right.
If you translate the word, it's struggle. And there's two different kinds of struggle. The main struggle is a struggle for internal peace with God. The secondary struggle is the pursuit of justice. Now, it's this pursuit of justice that gets twisted a little bit by the Al-Qaeda types to say, in order to have justice, we have to go and kill innocent people and use terrorism to scare the shit out of other people's governments. But it's those little twists of, you know, you automatically assume jihad means holy war. Doesn't mean that at all. And most Muslims will tell you that the kind of jihad that Al-Qaeda proposes is totally contrary to the Muslim faith. It's banned to kill innocents for any political purpose.
Right.
That is an absolute, you know, like a mortal sin in Christianity. And that's what 80%, 90%, maybe 99% of Muslims believe, that these killing innocents is a bad, bad, bad thing.
And in case any of the neocons are listening, and we're not advocating the idea that Al-Qaeda is not trying to inflict its own damage on the United States. Of course they are. They're trying to inflict damage not just here, but all over the place. But that doesn't mean that the other conclusion that you can draw, that somehow all of Islam is full of extremists, is justified, because it's not. Well, we've reached the end of the program, Bill, but it's been a pleasure as usual.
Yep.
And we'll see you all next time here on the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. Goodbye, everybody. Talking about